8. Around the World. Indonesia did indeed become a quiet, compliant partner of the United States, which explains why so many Americans today have barely heard about the country. But at the time, things were very different. The annihilation of the world's third-largest communist party, the fall of the founder of the Third World Movement, and the rise of a fanatically anti-communist military dictatorship violently rocked Indonesia, setting off a tsunami that reached almost every corner of the globe. In the long term, the shape of the global economy changed forever, and the scale of the anti-communist victory and ruthless efficiency of the method employed inspired extermination programs named after the Indonesian capital. But first, that giant bloody wave wrought short-term consequences as it crashed onto shores around the world. Vietnam. U.S. strategy in Southeast Asia was dictated to a large degree by the logic of the domino theory, which posits that as one country in Asia fell to communism, so could the rest of the region. This theory is well remembered to this day. What is completely forgotten is that Indonesia was by far the biggest domino. When influential officials in Washington realized how decisive their victory was in Jakarta, they came to a conclusion. They could afford to lose the battle in Vietnam because the war was already won. The fall of the PKI greatly reduced America's stakes in Vietnam, is the way that Robert McNamara put it, summarizing the 1966 opinion of George F. Kennan, who invented the Cold War containment strategy. Fewer dominoes now existed, and they seemed much less likely to fall. Later, McNamara himself looked back on his own pro-war views on Vietnam in 1965 and concluded regretfully that he and other high-level officials took no account of the centuries-old hostility between China and Vietnam or of the setbacks to China's political power caused by recent events in Indonesia. By 1967, when McNamara recommended against escalating the war, he pointed to the communists' defeat in Indonesia and the Cultural Revolution then roiling China, arguing that these events showed the trend in Asia now ran in our favor. In the end, McNamara was right. Officials in Washington lost the Vietnam War, but they still got, eventually, the version of Southeast Asia that they always wanted. Then there were the actual people of Vietnam. Southeast Asia's second-largest communist party, until the Indonesian communists had been destroyed when it became the largest, like much of the socialist world, responded to the events of October 1st with hesitation at first. The official organ of the party, The People, didn't comment on events in Indonesia until October 7th when the paper published a message from Ho Chi Minh to President Sukarno. It avoided the question of commenting on the September 30th movement entirely. "We are very delighted to hear that the president is well. We wish that you and the Indonesian people are able to continue with your revolution." Then, on October 9th and October 18th, The People published two headlines: "Forces in Indonesia, supported by the imperialist U.S., have for months planned a coup against President Sukarno," read the first one. The second read, "Imperialist U.S. and their cohorts are provoking an anti-communist campaign in Indonesia." Of course, as Washington's military engagement ramped up, Hanoi was hardly in a position to do anything about Indonesia. The Vietnamese communists did eventually win against the Americans, but at tremendous cost. 3 million Vietnamese people were killed in that war, and 2 million of them were civilians. Many more were killed in Cambodia and Laos. In Indochina, Washington's anti-communist crusade erased human life on a truly colossal scale with no appreciable positive results. The dynamics of the Vietnam War have been very well documented, especially compared to the attention paid to Indonesia. But one aspect often escapes attention, and it's a program with echoes of Guatemala in 1953, Iraq in 1963, and Indonesia in 1965. The U.S. military launched the Phoenix program with the assistance of Australia and the South Vietnamese government in 1968. The goal was to neutralize the enemy's administration through persuasion or assassination. This meant murdering civilians, not waging war. The military drew up blacklists and went hunting for its targets. Operation Phoenix killed tens of thousands of bureaucrats and unarmed people. One man working in the operation was already a veteran of Washington's anti-communist operations. A Cuban exile named Felix Rodriguez fought at the Bay of Pigs invasion, then he joined the CIA and led the operation that hunted down and executed Che Guevara in Bolivia in 1967. When finished there, he went to Vietnam to work in the super-secret Phoenix program. The Soviet Union. The Soviet Union reacted to the fall of Sukarno and the destruction of the PKI with mostly quiet resignation. On the one hand, by this point in the Sino-Soviet split, Moscow was not eager to see Beijing's outspoken ally succeed. On the other hand, Leonid Brezhnev, General Secretary since October 1964, was hoping to win the PKI and aid it back over to the Soviet side. After all, the Indonesian communists were still revisionists, according to Beijing, and Aidit, who never liked Khrushchev much, had tried to make a fresh start with Brezhnev. It appears that officials in Moscow, like most everyone else, were caught off guard by the events of October 1st and adopted a wait-and-see approach. On October 10th, Soviet leaders sent and published a letter to Sukarno wishing him sincere wishes of great success. After learning about the mass extermination program, Pravda asked in February 1966, "What for, and according to what right, are tens of thousands of people being killed?" The official communist paper reported that rightist political circles are trying to eliminate the Communist Party and at the same time eradicate the ideology of communism in Indonesia. They compared the slaughter to the White Terror unleashed in Russia in 1917. However, the Soviets did not actually take any decisive international action. Relations worsened between the two countries as Suharto consolidated power, of course, and the Soviets slowly wound down aid to Indonesia and its military. But there were no fierce denunciations at the UN or threats of retaliation. Harsh comments made by the Consul General of East Germany to the effect that the PKI has seriously failed in connection with the incidents of 30 September may indicate that privately, some major officials in the Soviet orbit believed the Indonesians had it coming. At least, they found justification for staying out of the way as communists were annihilated, as they often had before. But there were a lot of Indonesians living in the Soviet Union in 1965. Many of them were students at Patrice Lumumba University, set up in the early 1960s to educate visitors from the Third World. Since independence, Indonesian students had been sent all over the world to study, but as Sukarno moved to the left in the 1960s, opportunities in socialist countries increased relative to spots in the West. So, Gede Arka and Yarna Mansur, a young Indonesian couple from Bali and Sumatra, respectively, jumped at the opportunity to head to Moscow in 1963. They got a little bit of ideological training before they took off, mostly so they could spread the good news about Indonesia's revolution to the other students, but they weren't communists. They would have happily gone to England or the Netherlands to study if they could. They found Moscow cold, but also quite rich and developed. Everyone had healthcare, free education, the things Indonesians believed they deserved but hadn't received yet. Russian wasn't so hard. They'd been learning and switching between languages far more complex than that since childhood, so they were speaking and studying in the local tongue before long, alongside students from everywhere: Latin America, the Middle East, Japan, Cambodia, Thailand, India, Sri Lanka, Iran, and Iraq. After October 1, 1965, news of events back home became disjointed. They tuned into reports from Soviet radio, the BBC, and Radio Australia. None of it made sense. Worse, they were cut off from contact with their families back home. Things got even more confusing when the Indonesian embassy called them in to sign some declarations. First, they were asked to sign something condemning the murder of the six generals. They did happily. But then later they were asked to sign a form declaring allegiance to the new Suharto government. They hesitated. This didn't make much sense. They barely knew who this Suharto man was. This demand for allegiance split the sizable student population in Moscow. Some signed. Gede and Yarna did not. They figured and hoped that Sukarno, the president who had actually sent them abroad, would sort things out and return to power. This didn't happen. Because they didn't sign, they had their passports revoked and lost their citizenship, which is to say, they lost their country. The same thing happened to thousands of Indonesians around the world, all of whom became stateless, condemned to seek assistance from the place where they were stuck or wander across borders without a passport until they could find a government that would take them. They could not communicate with their families in Indonesia. They were marked as communists and as a result were fully and truly outcasts. Gede's uncle was killed in the anti-communist violence back in Bali. He was tortured, forced to watch his friends murdered in front of him, and then stabbed to death. Gede would only hear this full story when he was able to return to Indonesia 30 years later. Guatemala. Almost a decade after the CIA-engineered coup, Central America's largest country was not doing well. Washington still had a Cold War ally in power there, and Guatemala was still tightly integrated with the U.S. economy, but things had not exactly turned out as U.S. officials had hoped. For the rest of the 1950s, CIA agents watched the country sink back into feudal repression with some measure of regret. Then the Bay of Pigs invasion indirectly triggered a civil war, which would last for more than 3 decades. In November 1960, a group of junior officers led a small rebellion against President Miguel Irigoyen Fuentes, who had won an entirely fraudulent election after the general handpicked by Washington in 1954 was assassinated. The junior officers were very broadly left-leaning and shocked by the regime's levels of corruption and incompetence. But the spark for the revolt was the fact that the president had granted a base for CIA-backed Cuban exiles to prepare for their invasion of Cuba without asking them. The Cuban exiles were wealthy and reckless, driving impressive cars around the country. This was not only an insult to the military and its hierarchy, it was theft, because the president pocketed all the money the U.S. paid him. The revolt failed, but some of the officers formed a guerrilla group, the Movimiento Revolucionario 13 de Noviembre, MR-13, to openly rebel against the government. Another officer formed a rival group, Fuerzas Armadas Rebeldes, FAR, and began collaborating with the underground Communist Party, PGT, which had been nonviolent since its founding. By 1964, the United States and its local military partners, frustrated by their inability to contain the rebellion, changed tactics. They began a series of counterinsurgency actions in eastern Guatemala. They were assisted by a right-wing terror organization called the White Hand, La Mano Blanca, but victory was elusive. Totally undemocratic and governing a society that offered regular people no chance for advancement, the state had a very hard time establishing legitimacy. Its leaders pursued a different solution. They brought in 2 Americans from Southeast Asia as violence continued to roil Indonesia. In September 1965, a man named John Gordon Mine was appointed U.S. ambassador to Guatemala. He had served as first secretary of the embassy in Indonesia before Howard Jones began his ambassadorial post, and then alongside Jones as the director of the Office of Southwest Pacific Affairs in the State Department. Soon after, Mine requested the services of John P. Longan, a former Border Patrol officer in the U.S. who had worked with the CIA in Thailand and elsewhere. Longan had worked for the same Bangkok office that had authorized the supply of weapons to the Indonesian military during the killings. Soon after Longan arrived from Venezuela, he formed death squads. Within 3 months, they carried out Operation Cleanup, or Operacion Limpieza, which kidnapped, tortured, and executed 30 prominent left-wing figures in March 1966, just as Sukarno was stepping down in Indonesia. They didn't just kill them, though. They kidnapped and then disappeared them, murdering them without informing anyone what had happened. It's believed the events of 1965-66 in Indonesia were the first time Asia suffered from disappearances as a tactic of state terror. In 1965, 2 men with direct knowledge of U.S. activities in Indonesia arrived in Guatemala City. Historians who study violence in Latin America believe that 1966 in Guatemala was the first time the region suffered from disappearances as a tactic of state terror. The People's Republic of China. October 1st is a special date on the Communist Chinese calendar. It's National Day, the celebration of the founding of the People's Republic of China, which turned 16 years old in 1965. When Mao, Zhou Enlai, and Deng Xiaoping gave speeches that day in Tiananmen Square, some Indonesian students and leftists were in the crowd. At a banquet afterward, the Indonesians were the largest foreign delegation. As Suharto consolidated control over a new regime in Indonesia, anti-communists used the coincidence of that date to make bad-faith accusations that China had somehow engineered the September 30th movement. Beijing had neither the ability nor the intention to change Indonesia's government. Instead, Chinese officials were profoundly confused as to what was happening. At first, they believed a genuine right-wing coup had been stopped, then they thought that Sukarno would regain control of the country and continue to govern with the PKI supporting him, then they were alarmed that Sukarno was unwilling or unable to stop the army from raiding the homes of Chinese embassy staff in Jakarta. In December, when Mao learned of Dien Edit's death, he composed a poem. Sparse branches stood in front of my windows in winter, smiling before hundreds of flowers. Regretfully, those smiles withered when spring came. There is no need to grieve over the withered. To each flower there is a season to wither, as well as a season to blossom. There will be more flowers in the coming year. Apparently, as late as December, Mao thought the leftists would rise once more in Indonesia. Instead, they were being slaughtered, and anti-communist protesters and student groups increasingly targeted the Chinese embassy. In February, more than 1,000 right-wing youth attacked the building, and staff did their best to defend themselves with beer bottles, light bulbs, and kung fu. Taiwan's anti-communist, anti-Beijing government provided resources and training to these groups as they carried out more assaults. In total, the embassy was attacked more than 40 times. Reports of the clashes made their way back to China and became part of the official discourse of the budding Cultural Revolution. Suharto's dictatorship and the Cultural Revolution emerged in synchrony, says Taomu Zhou, the scholar who best knows Chinese documentation on Indonesia in the period. These two significant and stormy processes in Cold War Asia were mutually reinforcing, she writes, and the conflict with Indonesia greatly contributed to the growing socio-political mobilization during the early stages of the Cultural Revolution. Heroic resistance to the brutality of the likes of Suharto became one of the Red Guard's favored themes. First, enraged Chinese youth petitioned to put up posters to attack Indonesian reactionaries. Then the image of a Chinese diplomat who was injured in an embassy attack in Jakarta became a media sensation across the country. 600,000 Red Guards protested in front of Indonesia's embassy in Beijing. As ethnic Chinese refugees fleeing the violence in Indonesia arrived in China, they joined the Indonesian students and leftists already stranded there. Their stories of the horrors in their homeland became iconic during the Cultural Revolution, used as potent symbols of the dangers of right-wing violence and the need to heroically resist imperialism. At an event with some of these refugees, in front of a crowd waving the Little Red Book, Foreign Minister Chen Yi declared, "The Chinese people, armed with Mao Zedong thought, cannot be humiliated. The overseas nationals of strong socialist China can never be persecuted." He continued, "The savage Indonesian reactionaries will ultimately face the harsh judgment of history." The Cultural Revolution was built around the idea that hidden bourgeois elements could infiltrate and threaten a left-wing movement. The events in Indonesia in 1965-66 served as self-evident justification for this narrative. Just weeks previously, the world's largest unarmed communist party had held considerable influence in the huge country across the South China Sea. Mao and Zhou Enlai had encouraged the Indonesian leftists to arm the people. It did not. Then overnight, hidden right-wing elements emerged to kill them all and turn a left-leaning anti-imperialist nation into an ally of Washington. It would be the perfect propaganda tale to invent if it were not all true. The United States. U.S. government officials were almost uniformly celebratory of the massacres in Indonesia, even as their scope and brutality became clear. Ironically, one dissenting voice on this topic came from the man with a reputation for pushing for the most violent and reckless covert operations in the early 1960s. In January 1966, Senator Bobby Kennedy said, "We have spoken out against the inhuman slaughters perpetrated by the Nazis and the communists, but will we speak out also against the inhuman slaughter in Indonesia, where over 100,000 alleged communists have not been perpetrators but victims?" No other prominent U.S. politician condemned the massacre. By this time, RFK was in the habit of speaking out forcefully in ways that others wouldn't. It's unclear whether he knew that the Johnson administration was actively assisting with the massacre at that point. Maybe RFK had a kind of conversion about the nature of black ops after his brother's death. Maybe it was politics. But we know that whatever it was, Washington did not stop helping to carry out Operation Annihilation. The U.S. economic elite heard a very different message. Indonesia was open for business. In 1967, the first year of Suharto's fully consolidated rule, General Electric, American Express, Caterpillar, and Goodyear Tire all came to explore the new opportunities available to them in Indonesia. Starkist Foods arrived to see about fishing in Indonesian waters, and of course, defense contractors Raytheon and Lockheed popped over too. James Lennon, president of Time Life, went a step further. He contacted both the embassy and Suharto himself, expressing interest in putting on a major business conference focusing on Indonesian opportunities. Ambassador Green said this seemed to him like an excellent idea because a number of American companies, particularly in the extractive industries, were already in Jakarta. Lennon wrote to Suharto, "I had the privilege of visiting your country last fall and was most favorably impressed with the progressive developments that have been taking place. It occurred to me that an international investment conference could be a most productive undertaking." Suharto agreed. They began preparations for a swanky get-together in Geneva that fall. At least 1 million Indonesians were still in concentration camps, comprising one of the largest populations of political detainees anywhere in the world. They were subject to starvation, forced labor, physical and psychological torture, and attempts at anti-communist re-education. The families of up to another 1 million victims were reeling from the disappearance of their loved ones, without explanation and often without confirmation they were even dead. Bodies were strewn about the country. Sakono was imprisoned, Magdalena was imprisoned and badly confused, Francisca was in the process of giving up on her husband and finding a way to escape the country and keep the rest of her family safe. Judging by the materials prepared after the conference, titled To Aid in the Rebuilding of a Nation, the meeting in Geneva was a roaring success. Undersecretary of State George Ball was there, new Foreign Minister Adam Malik, a longtime Washington favorite in Indonesia, gave a speech emphasizing the importance of the military as the only credible political power in Indonesia, and David Rockefeller made some very encouraging final remarks. "I have talked with a good many people over the course of the last couple days, and I think I have found universal enthusiasm." Cambodia. Like Sukarno, Prince Norodom Sihanouk had attempted to maintain his neutrality in the Cold War since Cambodia's participation in the Bandung Conference in 1955, but his relationship with Washington became increasingly strained from years of CIA plotting and the escalation of the Vietnam War. At the same time, a man born Salat Sar, but known now to the world as Pol Pot, was leading a very small group of idiosyncratic Marxists camped out near the Vietnamese border. His group, then called the Workers' Party of Kampuchea, had almost no public support and alternately collaborated and quarreled with the more experienced and much busier Vietnamese communists to his east. Pol Pot had ignored directives from both the Soviet Union and the Vietnamese to keep peace with Sihanouk's government, and his group was organizing a rural rebellion. Pol Pot and his followers were also paying very close attention to Indonesia. They studied the collapse of the PKI and concluded that its strategy of aligning with Sukarno and winning mass democratic support had only led to disaster. As a result, he vowed that his movement would not meet the same fate at the hands of reactionaries and resolved that power for his group would be achieved and maintained through arms and violence. The PKI had no arms and trusted far too much in democratic niceties. That was its downfall, the secretive leader of the Khmer Rouge concluded. He would be different. Ghana. If sub-Saharan Africa had a Sukarno, it was likely Ghana's Kwame Nkrumah. Born to a poor family in what was then called the Gold Coast, as usual in the Third World, it was named for a precious commodity by its British colonizers, and educated at the historically black Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, he saw firsthand how virulent racism defined black life in the United States. At first, authorities in London viewed him as a threat, then briefly saw him as useful until he was a problem again. In 1957, he helped create Ghana, the first independent nation in sub-Saharan black Africa. He was a socialist and opposed to Western imperialism. He wanted to change the rules of the world economy to favor formerly colonized peoples, and by the 1960s, he rivaled Sukarno on the world stage as the man who most loudly railed against neocolonialism. In his 1965 book, Neocolonialism: The Last Stage of Imperialism, he wrote that neocolonialism is the worst form of imperialism. According to Nkrumah, the new way of the world was that foreign capital is used for the exploitation rather than for the development of the less developed parts of the world, and that imperial powers no longer even had to admit what they were doing, not even to themselves. In 1966, while the U.S. was still assisting in the extermination of Indonesia's leftists, Nkrumah was deposed in a military coup backed by the United States and Britain. The role of the CIA is still unclear. It is established, however, that the coup plotters had trained in the United Kingdom. Nkrumah took refuge in Guinea, then led by Third World Movement ally Ahmed Sekou Touré. By the end of the 1960s, it was safe to say that the Third World Movement was in disarray, if not destroyed. The Bandung spirit had become a ghost. The leaders of the progressive wing of the post-colonial movement were gone. Nehru had died in 1964, Sukarno was languishing in Indonesia as his allies bled out, waiting to die soon himself, Ghana's Nkrumah and Burma's UNU had been deposed in military coups. Many of Iraq's leftists were already dead, and U.S.-backed Saddam Hussein would finish them off soon. Egypt's Nasser had been weakened by the collapse of the United Arab Republic following a coup in Damascus, whose leaders in turn purged the Syrian Communist Party. Living in Guinea, Nkrumah came to a new conclusion about the nature of neocolonialism. Given the state of the world, and considering the success of Western imperialism, the only path to revolution was protracted guerrilla struggle. As Vijay Prashad, director of the Tricontinental Institute, put it, the destruction of the left had an enormous impact on the Third World. The most conservative, even reactionary social classes attained dominance over the political platform created in Bandung. As an adjunct to the military regimes, the political forces that emerged rejected the ecumenical anti-colonial nationalism of the left and the liberals for a cruel cultural nationalism that emphasized racialism, religion, and hierarchy. Or, in the words of German historian Christian Gerlach, speaking about the body that had probably been the best global forum for advancing the Third World Movement, by 1971, a murderer like Indonesian Foreign Minister Adam Malik could even become president of the UN General Assembly. Chile. In 1964, the Christian Democratic Party easily won presidential elections in Chile, one of Latin America's most stable and prosperous nations. The Christian Democrats were the party favored by Washington and the CIA, and they received very significant help from Uncle Sam. The agency pumped $3 million into that election. That came out to almost a dollar per vote for Eduardo Frei, more than Lyndon Johnson spent in his own 1964 campaign. In addition to funds, the CIA also delivered a crude scare campaign to the Chilean people. The agency made extensive use of the press, radio, films, pamphlets, and posters, and painted the walls of the cities. One red-baiting radio ad featured the sound of a machine gun operated by murderous communists, followed by a woman declaring, "They have killed my child." There were up to 20 radio spots of this kind per day. The CIA also distributed disinformation and black propaganda, falsely attributing materials to the Communist Party. Chile had been a stable democracy since 1932, and Frei was no dictator. He initiated a modest land reform program, made efforts to bring regular people into the educational system, and made taxation a bit more progressive. This long, thin country on South America's cold Pacific coast was nothing like Guatemala, where the generals ruled through terror, or even most of its neighbors closer to home, which were periodically rocked by military coups. It was Latin America, yes, inequality was rampant, and the racial hierarchy was obvious to any visitor, but many middle-class Chileans remember the 1960s as a pleasant time. Supporters of the second-place finisher that year, Salvador Allende, and other leftists in the country believed that a move towards socialism could happen Chilean style without much fuss or trouble and help the country to develop on more equal terms. But the virulence of the 1964 campaign had been a shock. Carmen Hertz was 19, studying at the University of Chile, and she and her friends understood very well how strongly Washington opposed Allende and his assorted allies. Growing up in a strict, well-off, and conservative home, with afternoon tea more reminiscent of the England of Mary Poppins than the mountains of Cuba, she arrived at the college in braids and 16 years old. She had been sympathetic to the right-leaning Liberal Party while living at home, but a growing social consciousness pushed her to the left, and her personality had always been a bit radical and confrontational. There were two left-wing groups active around her at the time. On the one side was the Communist Party, PCCH. Its members were more conservative in every sense of the word. Short hair, moral rectitude, and discipline were their identifying characteristics. They represented one of the more important communist parties in the world, one with its mass base in the working class, tightly disciplined and maintaining good relations with Moscow. They followed the Soviet line on Latin America at the time, and so insisted that the left should participate in elections and work within the democratic system, bourgeois or not, that Chile had. The other group, Movimiento de Izquierda Revolucionaria, MIR, was new and very much a creation of the 1960s. Its members were more bohemian, and they looked not to boring old Brezhnev, but to Che Guevara, inspired by his model of guerrilla warfare and the lessons he learned in Guatemala in 1954. They thought the road to democratic socialism was a trap, and they worried they would be swallowed up by reactionary forces before they could get halfway there. They told the communists, no, the only way is armed resistance. Both sides noticed what had happened in Indonesia. Orlando Mias, a Communist Party official, had visited Jakarta recently and spoke at length with Adit about their worries that Washington was planning something against them. Both leftist groups, the PCCH and the MIR, were horrified to hear about a massacre on a scale they considered impossible in Latin America. The leftists at Carmen's university were united in thinking that the future belonged to them and that they would win soon, but it was the members of MIR who seized upon the violence in Indonesia to make their point about tactics. Carmen remembers her radical friends saying, "You see what happens if you leave yourselves vulnerable?" In 1966, the MIR newspaper Punto Final published a text attributed to philosopher Bertrand Russell. "I fear that the horror of the killings in Indonesia was only possible because in the West we are so saturated with racism that the death of Asians, even in the hundreds of thousands, doesn't impress us. Blacks in North America know it well," the article continued. Knowing the same thing, the peoples of the world should take the path of open struggle. Punto Final also published a guide to CIA activities in Indonesia, the Congo, Vietnam, and Brazil. The paper got some details wrong, but just as was the case when Harjan Rakhiat covered Guatemala in 1954, Chile's left-wing press described events in Indonesia more accurately than the mainstream U.S. press at the time. While she studied at the University of Chile, Carmen was more sympathetic to the MIR than to the Communist Party, though she had a verbal sparring partner in Carlos Berger, a wild soccer fan who had been a disciplined, polite Communist Party member since he was 14. He was a man of incredible integrity, she realized, that is, in the old-school communist way. He was totally devoted to the cause, to moral living. Nothing was for himself. Everything was for a bigger cause. The events in Indonesia would be a point in the MIR's favor in those ideological debates, Carmen thought. The violence did seem to support the MIR position, just as the 1954 coup in Guatemala had been proof for Che that peaceful revolution wasn't possible. Still, the Communist Party remained unconvinced. It wasn't the 1950s anymore, and this was mature Chile, the thinking went, not Central America or a little island in the Caribbean. Allende himself had become more radical after he heard about what happened in Guatemala in 1954. But like Carlos and the Communist Party, he believed in Chile's institutions. Thailand. In 1965, Benny was living in Bangkok. After finishing his studies so close to all those generals in Kansas, he went on to get his PhD in economics at the University of Texas and then landed a job with the United Nations. Thailand was a reliably pro-Western country, so that was where the regional UN headquarters were located. It was also where the CIA was based in the region, and the KGB had some agents there too. Both groups kept asking Benny out for food or drinks, perhaps trying to get information from him or to feel him out as a possible asset. Benny would go and just engage in small talk, entirely bemused by the whole thing. The CIA man who kept asking Benny to lunch was named Alan Fuhrer, which was hilarious to Benny and his UN colleagues, because, well, that's literally what Hitler was called. What made Benny laugh even more was that the CIA and the KGB men seemed not to know what his job was or what he could do for them. He was on the economic side of UN activities and had nothing to do with the political work, so they would be wasting their time even if he had any interest in helping them, which he did not. Benny also watched as Bangkok slowly began to turn into a destination for sex tourism. American soldiers would visit for their rest and recreation breaks from the war in Vietnam. The steady inflow of GIs transformed parts of the city into a kind of factory row for prostitution. Benny overheard those men talking about what they were doing back in Vietnam. There was a bar, Rendezvous, where the pilots would come and get drunk, and they'd just let it rip. "I dropped a load of fucking bombs on that village," they'd say, as soon as they fell into the chairs. The world didn't quite know yet, but Benny knew just from hanging out at Rendezvous that something very disturbing was beginning to take place to his east. The pilots were clearly describing indiscriminate bombing and the massacre of civilians. Benny first heard about the September 30th movement on Radio Australia, which means, as he would find out only later, he actually heard a version broadcast by a station actively assisting in a psychological warfare campaign against the PKI. He was sitting in the garden with his wife, who was pregnant with their second child. Later, a man from the embassy came to ask him some questions. Did he know anything about Jakarta? What did he think? He didn't know anything, he said. He really didn't. As things worsened back home, Indonesians all around the world were being forced to declare their allegiances, and Benny's Chinese heritage made the new government doubly suspicious. His wife was also part of an Indonesian women's group, a semi-compulsory organization of Indonesian wives and UN workers living abroad who supported Sukarno's causes, such as his conflict with Malaysia. Benny was called into the embassy for interrogation. The question was very simple. Who are your best friends in Jakarta? Benny had to be strategic now. He had always been opposed to communism, but never anti-Sukarno. He figured he knew exactly what to say to these interrogators. He gave them the names of rich, well-connected Catholic Indonesians who were forming an anti-communist nucleus around Suharto. He knew them from his days at the expensive private school he had attended and figured they would vouch for him. It worked. He was allowed to get back to work at the UN. But in 1968, a military attaché in Bangkok contacted Benny with a friendly warning. The name he was born with, Hong Lan Wei, was too Chinese. Suharto had severed relations with China and banned all Chinese language materials in Indonesia. Even Chinese characters were banned. The government had passed legislation strongly recommending that Chinese Indonesians drop names of Chinese origin. Benny had gotten away with keeping his own name on his passport for a while because he was outside the country and working at the UN. But he had two options. Either he would drop his family name, or he would be subjected to periodic harassment and interrogation. Like so many Indonesians of Chinese descent, he picked a Javanese-sounding last name. From then on, he was officially Benny Widiono. In 1967, Southeast Asian nations came together in Bangkok to launch a new organization called ASEAN. Previously, only the Philippines, the Federation of Malaya, and Thailand, all Western-facing conservative powers, made up a group called the Association of Southeast Asia. But now, with Suharto in power in Indonesia, the region's largest country and young Singapore joined them to form the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. A few things united them: authoritarian developmentalism, close ties with Washington, and most importantly, anti-communism. In the 1970s, Thailand's government would kill thousands of people in its own anti-communist purge. Cuba. In 1963, President Sukarno had sent his old friend A.M. Hanafi to Havana to serve as Indonesia's first ambassador to Cuba in the age of Fidel Castro. He wasn't a communist, but he was a committed revolutionary, loyal to the president since the days of the struggle against the Dutch back in the 1940s. He got along well with Fidel and Che, and his family settled into a luxurious neighborhood on the Caribbean coast. His daughter, Nuri, was 17. She was impressed. Havana was more modern, more elegant than Jakarta. She was amazed to see that some of the grand houses in her neighborhood were filled with young students. How lucky, she thought. She couldn't believe that youngsters like her would be allowed to live here and spend all day just studying like this. She only found out later, as she began her own studies in Cuba, that this part of the city had served as the bordel of the United States, a vacation paradise for playboys and mafia types, and that the houses had been reclaimed by the revolution. That explained a lot. As a child back in Jakarta, she had intimately felt the effects of political conflict. One of the attempts to assassinate Sukarno, maybe carried out by the Islamists, by the CIA, who knew, consisted of throwing a grenade into Nuri's school in the downtown neighborhood of Chikini as he was visiting one day. Things felt a lot calmer in Cuba, at least in her corner of town. Her father, now Ambassador Hanafi, was planning the Tricontinental Conference, an ambitious expansion of the Bandung Project set for January 1966. Then, while he was away for business, Nuri heard about the events in Jakarta of October 1, 1965. Hanafi didn't return as planned. Nuri and her family only got patches of information before learning that he had gone to visit Sukarno at the palace in Bogor. Suharto, now effectively in power, made Hanafi an offer in an attempt to get him to join his new government. He refused, saying that Sukarno had posted him to Cuba as ambassador, and that was the mission he was going to carry out. At least, that's what he told Nuri and the family when he arrived back in Havana. Not long after, his job disappeared because the embassy in Havana disappeared. He and his whole family lost their Indonesian passports. Fidel, of course, understood. He and Che had built their entire revolution on the premise that Washington could strike to destroy third world governments at any time, and he had survived countless attempts on his own life. He was hardly surprised that the ambassador and his family were stranded in Havana by the forces of imperialism. Even though Hanafi had lost his job and diplomatic protection, Fidel stepped in, gave them a nice house in the exclusive neighborhood of Cubanacan, and found Hanafi a job giving lectures on Asian history and the Indonesian Revolution. The Tricontinental Conference, officially called the Solidarity Conference of the Peoples of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, did take place in Havana in January 1966 without the participation of the country that spearheaded the Third World Movement. In attendance, however, was Salvador Allende, the Chilean socialist and supporter of the Third World Movement, who had been the presidential runner-up to Frei in the 1964 election. Nuri lost contact with her family and all her friends back in Jakarta. She and her father were considered communists now, and it was dangerous for anyone from their old life to speak with them. She settled into a life in Havana. Taiwan. The Republic of China, the state set up by Chiang Kai-shek's nationalists in Taiwan, still insisted on its claim to mainland China and had long been home to active anti-communist crusaders. The small dictatorship run from Taipei paid close attention to the massacre in Indonesia, sponsoring attacks on the Chinese embassy in Jakarta as a way to weaken both Sukarno and Mao's regime in Beijing. In 1966, Taiwan and South Korea, still run by Park Chung-hee, the dictator installed with the help of Marshall Green before Green took over for Howard Jones as U.S. ambassador in Indonesia, came together to found the World Anti-Communist League, WACL. Congressman Walter Judd and U.S. religious figures flew out to attend the first meeting. The new global organization, built on a structure provided by the existing Asian People's Anti-Communist League, brought together moderate conservatives as well as far-right radical groups that had carried out atrocities for Hitler in World War II in countries like Romania and Croatia. It would go on to hold yearly conferences around the world, allowing its members to exchange support, intelligence, and tips for the rest of the Cold War, and was now, alongside the Brazil-founded Tradition, Family, and Property Organization, one of two such anti-communist organizations with global reach. The WACL also began to recruit students for the Political Warfare Cadres Academy in the Beitou District in Taipei. Like military academies set up by the United States, the Beitou School began to train soldiers for the global anti-communist struggle. Hawaii. In 1965, just after he retired from the State Department and left Indonesia, former Ambassador Howard Jones took over as Chancellor at the East-West Center at the University of Hawaii. He kept in contact with the embassy and watched as the situation deteriorated rapidly, but had no more control over events. There at the East-West Center in Honolulu, a young Indonesian employee of the armed forces named Lolo Sotoro met and fell in love with an American anthropologist. He wasn't a soldier, but he worked for the military's topographical service and had won a grant to study geography in Hawaii. He was a short, handsome man from a big Javanese family that had felt the violence of colonialism. In Indonesia's Revolutionary War, the Dutch killed his father and brother, then burned their house down. In March 1965, Lolo married Ann Dunham and became the stepfather to her son from a previous marriage with a Kenyan economics student. But then in 1966, as Suharto solidified his control over the country, Lolo was abruptly summoned back home, just like so many other Indonesians around the world. He obeyed, and over the next few months, Anne and her 5-year-old son made preparations to go live with him as well. Barack Obama's memories of life as a young boy in Jakarta from 1967 to 1971, published in his book Dreams from My Father, provide a vivid picture of life in the capital as Suharto's government and the U.S. State Department attempted to move on from the violence they had just finished inflicting on the country. The rule was silence. At first, neither young Barry, as he was then known, nor Anne knew why Lolo had come back or the nature of his work. Barack Obama remembers that soon after they arrived, they were driving and his mother used the word Sukarno in a sentence. "Who's Sukarno?" Barry yelled from the back seat. Lolo ignored the question. He was working in West Papua, surveying the area that Sukarno had won from the Dutch with Kennedy's help just a few years before. Lolo would go on trips, Obama remembers, and came back with wild animals for his adventurous young stepson to admire. But Anne and Barry both noticed that Lolo had changed since Hawaii. It was as if he had pulled into some dark hidden place out of reach, taking with him the brightest part of himself. On some nights, she would hear him up after everyone else had gone to bed, wandering through the house with a bottle of imported whiskey, nursing his secrets. To busy herself and fight the loneliness, Anne got a job at the embassy Howard Jones had left 2 years earlier. It was there she realized how ugly and racist the old white men working for her government could be. They'd insult the locals until they realized she was married to one and try to walk their comments back. She realized that some of these men, the occasional supposed economist or journalist, would mysteriously disappear for months at a time, and it was never clear what these secretive men were really doing. It was also there that she found out very slowly what had happened just before they arrived. Over lunch or casual conversation, they would share with her things she couldn't learn in the published news reports, Obama wrote. Innuendo, half-whispered asides, that's how she found out that we had arrived in Jakarta less than a year after one of the more brutal and swift campaigns of suppression in modern times. The idea frightened her, the notion that history could be swallowed up so completely, the same way the rich and loamy earth could soak up the rivers of blood that had once coursed through the streets, the way people could continue about their business beneath giant posters of the new president as if nothing had happened. The more she found out, the more she asked Lolo, and the more frustrated she became as he refused to answer. Finally, one of his cousins explained the situation and told her to try to be understanding. "You shouldn't be too hard on Lolo," the cousin said. "Such times are best forgotten." They grew further apart as he took a new job working for UNOCAL, the U.S. energy company. She didn't want to go to his company dinner parties, where Texas oilmen bragged about bribing officials and their wives complained about the quality of the Indonesian help. It became clear to her and to him that they were American and privileged in a way Lolo was not, and that as a result, he was bound to a life that maybe they did not want. Anne could speak out, knowing she would never lose her American citizenship or the comforts back home, but Lolo was constantly forced into painful moral dilemmas. People in his world were forced either to stay silent and try to get ahead in life, or to speak up and face the risk of poverty, starvation, even death. She couldn't stay there anymore. Once, before they returned to Hawaii, Barry had the idea of asking Lolo if he had ever seen a man killed. He glanced down, surprised by the question. "Have you?" I asked again. "Yes," he said. Was it bloody? Yes. I thought for a moment. Why was the man killed, the one you saw? Because he was weak. That's all? Lolo shrugged and rolled his pant leg back down. That's usually enough. Men take advantage of weakness in other men. They're just like countries in that way. The strong man takes the weak man's land. He makes the weak man work in his fields. If the weak man's woman is pretty, the strong man will take her. He paused to take another sip of water, then asked, "Which would you rather be?"